It's 4:06. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. Coming up later, we talk to the second man on the moon, Buzz Aldrin, about why he says we should colonize Mars.
First, a teen sexting case out of North Carolina is making national headlines for the severity of possible punishment. In the case, a 17-year-old student is facing child pornography charges and possible sex offender status for consensually exchanging sexual images with his girlfriend. Since the two are minors, the sending of those photos is considered a felony offense under state law.
That's because in North Carolina and here in Wisconsin, there's no specific statute on the books directly addressing teen sexting, meaning a similar situation could in theory play out here in Wisconsin. And some states have updated their laws to include sexting. And that's got our next guest wondering, is it time for Wisconsin to follow suit?
Dave Stiegel joins us now. He's a criminal defense attorney and shareholder with Lawton and Cates. Dave, thanks for joining us today.
No problem. Thank you for having me.
Well, let's take a look at Wisconsin. If teen sexting isn't specifically addressed in current law, what happens if it were to go to court here in the state?
Yeah, like the case you referenced in North Carolina, our laws are currently the same. Wisconsin does not have a specific statute that addresses what's commonly referred to as sexting, which leaves prosecutors with really blunt tools. The options available for charging are typically child pornography charges or a variant of that, which is called exposing a child to harmful material. Both of those are felonies, and both can come with pretty severe consequences.
So if a teen sexting case, a teen shares explicit photos, say, of themselves, but that ends up in court, in theory, what kind of punishment could they be looking at under those charges you just mentioned?
Sure. It would depend on what is charged. But worst case scenario, a conviction for child pornography, if it got to that point, could result in a mandatory prison sentence, believe it or not. Otherwise, if it was something less than that, it could be a period of supervision in the community under the terms of probation or a jail sentence that would be under 12 months.
So does it come down to a prosecutor's discretion on which charge to file, if any, and which punishment a teen could be at risk of?
That's exactly right. So if the police do an investigation and they, like I think happened, what happened in that North Carolina case, they discover these images on one or more cell phones, if they believe a crime's been committed, they'll refer that investigation for criminal charges to the county district attorney. That prosecutor's office has tremendous discretion. They can decide to either issue felony charges, to issue, if there's a factual basis, maybe some kind of lesser charge, or maybe not to bring charges at all. There are other tools that they can use, diversion agreements, try to divert people out of the criminal justice system. But you're right, the upfront decision rests with the local prosecutor.
Talking to Dave Stiegel about sexting, sharing explicit images on a cell phone or other technology, and how the laws apply especially to teens who might share images of themselves. In some cases, they could be charged, maybe even as adults, for child pornography for sharing that image of themselves. So, Dave, are you hoping that the state changes laws, gives specific laws on this issue? And if so, what would those look like?
Sure, I do. Sexting cases were relatively unheard of even 5, 6, 7, 8 years ago. If you look at the volume that's being reported of people, especially younger people, teenagers trading images, whether sexually explicit or not, the volume of that, Snapchat, for instance, reports 700 million images exchanged a day. If you see that more and more frequency, this is going to be brought to the criminal justice system. And leaving these very blunt tools, I think, is a recipe for injustice. Some of the possibilities, the other states that have enacted specific statutes, they're usually categorized as misdemeanor or petty offenses if it's two younger people consensually exchanging sexting images. Other areas for improvement would be maybe building in an affirmative defense that if there's evidence that a person received an image but took actions to delete that image relatively quickly, that could give the person a legal defense. None of that is an option under the current state of the law, unfortunately.
And another issue is the person, maybe a teen, who shares an image that they've received consensually, maybe from somebody else, but then shares it non-consensually. Is that something that the law needs to catch up with?
Yeah, the situation that you described, Rob, I think happens fairly often, where if it's two young people that consensually exchange images, and then one of those parties decides to share those images with other friends or whoever, there is a statute that addresses that in Wisconsin, but similar to the child pornography laws, it's a felony offense, or can be a felony offense, if the person is over, or if the person is under 18 years of age. And that statute, although it's more modern, still lacks some of the characteristics that at least I think would be helpful, such as delineating maybe the number of images that are transmitted, or, like I said, building in some sort of affirmative defense to show that a person tried to delete this image soon after receipt.
You blogged about this issue recently, Dave, and you made it clear, while you'd like to see the laws change, you're not encouraging anyone to do this, to sext.
Yes. I think it's a bad idea on a lot of fronts. And I think when I talk to parents or even young people that have either been being investigated or have been charged with this, they are usually aghast at the severity of the situation. And I think had they known some of that information beforehand, they may have decided to make a little better decisions just not to engage in this in the first place.
And you're looking for any changes here to be specific to teens. Is that correct? Adults sharing images like this?
Yeah, it's much more. Yeah, my recommendations would be to target it at teens specifically. When you get into the facts where it's an adult having images of someone under 18, that becomes much less clear cut. The case in North Carolina where it's teenagers consensually trading information or sending information, that's the area that I think the law could benefit for some updating and modifications.
Briefly, Dave, advice for parents on this issue.
My biggest advice to parents is, as uncomfortable as it may be, to talk to your children about this. I call it the technology talk. There's a lot of parents that, for better or worse, aren't necessarily up to speed on the latest and greatest in social media. And becoming aware of that and discussing with your child the potential risks and dangers associated with this kind of behavior will hopefully go a long way into keeping that child out of this situation from the get-go.
Dave, thanks a lot for joining us today.
No problem. It's my pleasure. Thank you.
That was Dave Stiegel. He's a criminal defense attorney. He's a shareholder with the firm Lawton & Cates. He joins to talk about the penalties for teen sexting in Wisconsin and the possibility for updating the law to specifically include sexting in those situations. On July 21st, 1969, astronaut Buzz Aldrin became the second person to walk on the moon. It was an event that captured the country's imagination and marked a huge accomplishment in the golden age of space exploration.
Well, it may seem that the golden age is behind us. When Aldrin looks to the future, he sees some much more ambitious projects ahead. Now he's advocating that we not only explore, but colonize. In his new book, Welcome to Mars, Making a Home on the Red Planet, he says we'll colonize Mars by the year 2040.
Buzz Aldrin, welcome to Central Time.
I'm happy to be with you.
So first of all, why do you think humans should be working toward colonizing Mars?
Well, I could almost read to you from my latest children's book, Welcome to Mars, because it really tells you why Mars is the most inhabitable planet in our solar system other than the Earth. And what we learn about studying the climate on Earth just may help us modify the climate on Mars, perhaps to what it might have been, we think, millions of years ago, very hospitable. The day is just a little longer there. The seasons are twice as long. And I've developed a system of transportation of cycling spaceships, a bit of which was cited in The Martian by Andy Weir, mm-hmm. as the cycling spaceship that drops people off and picks them up at Mars.
somewhere along the way, some humans are going to be the ones who make the first steps on Mars. Now, you were one of the first humans to make the first steps on the moon. Can you talk about what that experience was like, knowing that you were walking where no one else had set foot before?
Well, I watched Neil kind of shuffling around on the surface, picking up a contingency sample out of my window, and I could tell that moving around on Mars was going to be much simpler than we thought. So I got down to the bottom of the ladder and stepped on the moon, and I was just amazed at the boot prints were just so firm, and yet it was a dusty surface. And I used the words magnificent desolation to refer to the magnificence of human beings on this planet Earth, improving our transportation systems up to the point where we could land two people for a day or so on the surface of of the moon. But it was such a desolate place. And I knew that the day was 14 Earth days long and would get very, very hot in the night. 14 days long would be very, very cold, no air at all, and these extreme temperatures and the absence of the ability to grow things around, no life whatsoever, very desolate place.
Now, for those first people to land on Mars, is that what it'll look like to them, do you think, a magnificent desolation? What will they see as they look around them?
They will see many habitats that have been deployed years before they first set foot on the surface of Mars, along with a number of others, to begin to occupy permanently. And to the degree that we have assembled and checked out these habitats and all the life support systems from Earth on the equipment that has been landed maybe 6 years earlier by international construction and international landers, similar to the ones that have been used on the moon, to set up similar bases for other nations to use, as we don't compete with anyone else like China. We cooperate even more than that. We help them at the moon, and then they support by the same type habitats that they land, so that the U.S. transportation system, consisting of cycling orbits between Earth and Mars, being resupplied and alternating every other 26 months, which is the time when the Earth catches up with Mars, and that's the time when we can travel Earth to Mars or Mars to Earth.
Can you paint a picture of what life would be like on Mars for those first settlers staying in those pre-built habitats?
Well, I would be guessing, based on a lot of people who have studied all sorts of things about Mars, and then people who have gone to similar habitat regions here on Earth. We have been experimenting at the space station on growing edibles, lettuce, carrots, and other elements, probably hydroponically also, and maybe tilapia fish that could be used for protein. The oxygen can be processed from the water that is much more readily available on Mars, and we can use nuclear power systems or the dimmer sunlight to transform the water into hydrogen and oxygen to power transportation around the surface, and also for rockets to take samples and people perhaps up to the moon of Mars.
We're talking to Buzz Aldrin, one of very few humans to walk on the moon. He is the author of the new book, Welcome to Mars, Making a Home on the Red Planet, making the case for Mars colonization. Now you, Buzz, went up with NASA to the moon. Now there's a lot of private companies getting involved in trying to get into low orbit and beyond. Do you think there's a big role for private companies in developing these spaceships, these habitats, everything else we need to live on Mars?
Yes, there certainly is. Just like with aviation, the initial aviation were World War One aircraft, and after the war, why these were air racing and stunting, and occasionally having accidents. So the government said, "Why don't you carry the airmail from New York to Chicago and many other places?" And for a few years, that proved out to be just outstanding. And then we started carrying passengers. So we start out with government initiation of the more difficult activities, as we did, of course, with the early unmanned rockets, and then Alan Shepard, Gus Grissom, suborbital, John Glenn, first American into orbit, the Mercury program, then followed by the very ambitious Gemini program with two people, that did rendezvous, long-duration spaceflight, computer reentry outside the spacecraft. And I was fortunate to be one of the people on the last Gemini mission, Gemini 12, to train underwater neutral buoyancy. And I guess because of my early scuba diving almost 10 years earlier. But then I had the great experience to take the first selfie in space with a camera that was mounted on the spacecraft. I was standing in the open hatch and decided, why not see if this works and take a picture of myself between the nighttime ultraviolet photographic passes of stars.
Sometimes when people think of a space program, whether we're talking about the effort to land on the moon or space shuttles or now other planets, they say, hey, we've got a lot of problems here on Earth, famine, war, poverty that we need to solve. Space, great, but we shouldn't be putting our resources there. How do you answer that?
Well, I answer that by saying that countries, humans, will move outward in space, will be in orbit, will be on the moon, and will be at Mars. And if the United States wants to sit back and watch that happen, that's fine. It only took us 4% of discretionary funding in 1967, and we succeeded in putting two people for a day or two on the moon, and we did that 6 out of 7 times by the end of 1972, and discretionary funding went down, and right now it's 0.5%, and no one is on the moon. We haven't been capitalizing on those exploration efforts. Now, certainly, our young people, to be inspired, would like to be among the first people to journey to Mars and become the pilgrims permanently building up colonies on the surface of Mars, improving a bit on the new film coming out, The Martian, that will start putting people there, and they will stay there helping the others who will be landing subsequently, because we'll really be testing all of these things out as we improve the transportation and are able to get there within 2 decades of the 50th anniversary of man's first landing on the moon, July 20th, 2019. So that means we'll be occupying Mars by 2040.
You mentioned inspiring younger people with the space program, and you've this book, Welcome to Mars, is geared toward younger readers. Is that part of why you think we need to do this as something for younger people to strive for?
Well, absolutely. It's the young people who will be inheriting the pioneering developments that have been done by Silicon Valley and others throughout the country and the world that were based upon the surge of technology improvements that resulted from President Kennedy after Sputnik deciding we had to catch up with technology. Now, it happened to end up with a race with the Soviet Union, but that's because we had a lot of catching up to do. And we've been ahead for a while, and we did a joint mission with the Russians. Apollo Soyuz and its legacy resulted in surviving the breakup of the Soviet Union and in their space stations and our space station efforts, culminating in the International Space Station.
We'll leave it there. Buzz Aldrin, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
That was engineer and astronaut Buzz Aldrin. He was the second man to walk on the moon. His new book is called Welcome to Mars, Making a Home on the Red Planet.
This is what's wrong with this debate. We're not talking about real issues. And Mr. Trump, we don't need an apprentice in the White House. We don't need an apprentice in the White House. We have one right now.
That was Governor Walker in last night's Republican primary debate, exchanging barbs with Donald Trump. This is Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Walker came out of the gate swinging last night, accusing Donald Trump of not having clear policies and defending his own record in Wisconsin. But he faded into the background and ultimately came away with the shortest speaking time of any candidate.
The pundits have mostly proclaimed Carly Fiorina the winner of the debate. She was a new presence on the main stage after appearing in the so-called happy hour debate last time around. She won over the crowd with a number of zingers and didn't hesitate to take on Donald Trump.
The debate lasted over 3 hours and involved a lot more back and forth among the candidates than the previous debate. Here with us now to talk about who did well and who did not so well is David Friedlander, contributing writer at The Daily Beast. David, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Well, before we get to the person who's been proclaimed the star of the night, Carly Fiorina, let's talk about Wisconsin's own Governor Scott Walker. What was he trying to accomplish when he went into that debate last night?
So I think your governor really just needs to stop the bleeding. I mean, he has had a brutal couple of months. Everyone around him knows it, his donors, his staff. He's gone from being the top of the polls to near the bottom. So I think they were looking for a forceful and crisp performance from him that sort of shows the strength that vaulted him to the top of the polls, you know, in the spring.
And was he able to do it in what turned out to be, according to NPR, the shortest amount of speaking time at last night's debate?
You know, I actually thought he did okay, I mean, to be honest. I mean, I think his staff, if they had a sort of checklist of things they wanted to accomplish, I think Walker probably accomplished most of them. He took on Trump. He talked about his record in Wisconsin. You know, he was aggressive. I think he gave short and crisp answers. But I think he also sort of faded as the debate wore on, and he didn't really have much to say. You sort of forgot he was on stage, I think at points. And some of that was, as you mentioned earlier, you know, this was a debate where really they wanted the candidates to engage with each other and to argue with each other. And they brought up, you know, previous statements that they had said about one another, previous criticisms. And Walker hasn't really done that. He's not a guy who really goes around criticizing and drawing contrasts between his own record and that of his fellow candidates. So there wasn't a lot there for them to mine. And also, he has this persona of this sort of Wisconsin nice, right? He's the nice guy, the regular guy in the race. And he's not a kind of cutting, slashing type like Carly Fiorina is. So he wasn't really quite able to rise to her level. But I thought he did okay.
He said today on MSNBC that all of his eggs are in the basket called Iowa. Does that seem like a good strategy? Can he get enough results there to propel him forward? Or does that put too much pressure on his performance in Iowa?
No, I mean, I think that's probably the right strategy. You know, he was leading in Iowa for a long time. He's now cratered, I think, to 2% in the polls or something like that. But it's hard to imagine a Walker path of victory that doesn't go through Iowa, especially it's so close to y'all up there. And, you know, he needs to win Iowa if he's going to win the later states, the New Hampshire, South Carolina, and Nevada. The only path through those first four states for him is Iowa.
Now, going into this debate, one of the most highly anticipated interactions was going to be between Carly Fiorina and Donald Trump after he seemingly criticized her looks in an interview. Her response was pretty short. Here's a question and answer.
Ms. Fiorina, I do want to ask you about this. In an interview last week in Rolling Stone magazine, Donald Trump said the following about you. Quote, look at that face. Would anyone vote for that? Can you imagine that, the face of our next president? Mr. Trump later said he was talking about your persona, not your appearance. Please feel free to respond what you think about his persona.
You know, it's interesting to me. Mr. Trump said that he heard Mr. Bush very clearly and what Mr. Bush said. I think women all over this country heard very clearly what Mr. Trump said.
Now, with that moment and others in mind, David, what did you make of Carly Fiorina in the debate last night?
Well, you know, this was sort of keyed up for her in a way. I mean, she's a terrific debater. She's a sort of slashing, cutting presence on stage. She takes it right to Hillary Clinton in a way that the other candidates, frankly, can't. And I think it was, you know, as you mentioned, I mean, this was where all of the anticipation was. What's she going to say to Trump? How is she going to respond to this attack of his? And I thought she did so beautifully, frankly. I mean, it was one of the few times you sort of saw Trump flummoxed and not knowing quite what to say.
On more substantive issues, people have said she came off really solidly for an outsider candidate in particular, somebody who's not an experienced politician particularly, that she came off looking knowledgeable, well-informed on top of issues.
No, I think that's absolutely right. You know, and I think what's interesting here in a way is she's still a real long shot to be the nominee, as is Ben Carson, who's trailing Trump in the polls, as is Trump. I mean, if history is any guide, you know, Republicans sort of tend to get serious as these campaigns get closer, you know, get closer to voting in Iowa and the primary begins. And so she remains a real long shot. And I just wonder if she sort of replaces Trump, if she's the new Trump, then the party is that much further away from coalescing around an eventual nominee who, if history is any guide, is going to be someone from the political class who's got a lot of endorsements and a lot of money, a Jeb Bush, a Scott Walker, a Marco Rubio, a John Kasich, even a Ted Cruz. So we'll have to see how much longer this goes on.
A moment that shot up the charts on Google, according to Google Trends, Carly Fiorina became the most Googled candidate of any during the debate when she shared a personal story about her daughter.
I very much hope that I am the only person on this stage who can say this, but I know there are millions of Americans out there who will say the same thing. My husband Frank and I buried a child to drug addiction. So we must invest more in the treatment of drugs. I agree with Senator Paul. I agree with states' rights. But we are misleading young people when we tell them that marijuana is just like having a beer. It's not. And the marijuana that kids are smoking today is not the same as the marijuana that Jeb Bush smoked 40 years ago. We do. Sorry, Barbara.
A funny moment from a sad moment earlier in there, but a change of pace in a debate that had a lot of rapid back and forth. What did you make of that, David?
I thought it really humanized her in a way, and I think that she probably needs that humanizing. You know, I mean, she was the most aggressive person on that stage until that moment. I mean, she was the one who sort of talked the loudest, the sharpest, the fastest. If you notice, she was constantly interjecting the moderators. She was constantly going over her time. And, you know, she has in many ways, and it came up a little bit last night, I mean, she has a tough record for a nominee. She's someone who is a CEO, you know, and we know how that worked out with Mitt Romney, but in many ways she doesn't even really have the business record of Mitt Romney, although she does have the layoff. The Democrats are able to tag on him. So I think anything she can do to sort of soften some of those harder edges is probably to her benefit.
Talking to David Friedlander, contributing writer at The Daily Beast, about last night's Republican debate. Call in now with your thoughts, your reactions, your questions at 800-642-1234. So all this back and forth going on, David, between Fiorina and Trump. And Chris Christie had a moment when he tried to put a stop to it. Let's give a listen.
While I'm as entertained as anyone by this personal back and forth about the history of Donald and Carly's career, for the 55-year-old construction worker out in that audience tonight who doesn't have a job, who can't fund his child's education, I got to tell you the truth. They could care less about your careers. They care about theirs. Let's start talking about that,
Jake,
on this stage.
Jake,
and stop playing the games.
Governor
stop
Kasich,
playing, John, I'm not done yet, John.
No. A track record of
stop,
leadership
and
is
stop,
not a game.
And stop
it is
playing,
the issue
and
in
Carly,
this election.
Carly, listen. You can interrupt everybody else on the stage. You can interrupt me. Okay? The fact is that we don't want to hear about your careers. back and forth and volleying back and forth about who did well and who did poorly. You're both successful people. Congratulations. You know who's not successful? The middle class in this country who's getting plowed over by Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton. Let's start talking about the O's issues tonight and stop this childish back and forth between the two of you.
Ms. Fiorina, I want to get...
Chris Christie had a rough run of things lately, David, for quite a while now among Republican voters. Is this making him, I don't know, look like the adult in the room?
Yeah, I thought that was a great answer. And I thought that that was sort of his focus throughout the evening, was like, let's stop talking about us, let's stop squabbling amongst each other, and let's sort of talk about the voters and the American people watching this. I thought Christie, you know, had a great night. I really did. I mean, I think they had a checklist. I bet he hit every single one of the things they wanted to get done last night. You know, if there was, he sort of waded into Fiorina's lane at one point there, and she kind of elbowed him back, which wasn't a great look for him. But otherwise, I thought he had a terrific night.
Is he back on the charts now? A lot of Republican voters suspicious that he's not conservative enough for them.
Yeah, it's hard. So there's still, it's not right to say we're a long way away from voting, but voting's also not tomorrow, right? Sure. We're sort of a medium way. You know, voting is in the winter, and we're entering the fall here now. So, you know, he's got a lot of ground to gain. He's just barely hanging on there in 10th or 11th place. I mean, he's one of these guys lucky to be on the stage. I doubt one debate performance or one crisp answer is enough to really, you know, vault him to the top of the pack. But he clearly has a campaign that has some life in it.
Speaking of the top of the pack, in many polls, maybe most polls, Donald Trump has been there. He started off the debate in a way some people saw as odd. He took a swing at Kentucky Senator Rand Paul and then responded to the label of being an entertainer. Here he is.
First of all, Rand Paul shouldn't even be on this stage. He's number 11. He's got 1% in the polls, and how he got up here, there's far too many people. Anyway, as far as temperament, and we all know that, as far as temperament, I think I have a great temperament. I built a phenomenal business with incredible, iconic assets, one of the really, truly great real estate businesses. And I may be an entertainer because I've had tremendous success with number one bestsellers all over the place, with The Apprentice and everything else I've done. But I will tell you this, what I am far and away greater than an entertainer is a businessman. And that's the kind of mindset this country needs to bring it back.
A lot of people have responded to that mindset, that kind of talk. David, did Donald Trump keep up where he had been? Is he nobody's been able to predict him quite right so far, but do you think he'll stay where he is in the polls?
I mean, you know, I think we all have to have given up on what explains the Donald Trump phenomenon a long time ago. I mean, that bubble was supposed to have popped weeks or months ago. Those stories have already been written. He also had this gratuitous insult about Rand Paul's looks in that answer, which you didn't even get to there. Nothing explains why he's doing so well. I mean, you know, that it's self-aggrandizing, it's sophomoric, as it was called in the debate, and somehow people seem to respond to it. Whether or not they continue to, I don't know, because it's hard to know what they're responding to now. It's definitely a phenomenon like one we haven't seen before.
Talking to David Friedlander, contributing writer at the Daily Beast, looking at last night's Republican primary debate.
And we'd like to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Who do you think emerged victorious, or maybe not so much, last night? Have you made up your mind about any of the candidates? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We're continuing our conversation with David Friedlander, contributing writer at the Daily Beast, talking about last night's Republican primary debate.
And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Were there ideas that you heard last night that struck you, moments that you thought were telling about a candidate or two? What did you think about the overall style of the debate? Do you want to pick a winner? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll go to our callers. Kevin is on the line in Hudson. Kevin, hi.
Hi, good afternoon. Thank you for taking my call. I've got a question with regards to the general consensus is that Trump will at some point fall out. Not sure when. But at that point, he's going to have a lot of followers. It's said that he's got over 3 million just on Twitter. And was it a smart move for Governor Walker to confront Trump last night when, in fact, at some point... he may want to befriend Trump to get those followers.
Kevin, thanks.
Take my answer off the air.
Interesting question. David, what do you think?
Yeah, I think Walker maybe tried that for a while and wanted it treat Trump with kid gloves and welcome into the race and all that kind of thing. But as Walker just lost altitude, there was really no other option for him to do other than to try to get some attention by beating back on Trump and also like hoping that that phenomenon ends eventually. And I think it's also worth noting that, you know, Ted Cruz is really the sort of Donald Trump buddy act at this point, and he seems, if anyone, poised to inherit that mantle. But, you know, I don't know if politics really quite works that way, that, you know, you were able to just sort of drop out, but you have this large number of supporters that you could then hand over to one of your colleagues.
And thanks for the call, Kevin. I think conventional wisdom that Donald Trump was bluffing and wouldn't actually announce a campaign ever. But here he is.
It's defying everything we know about politics, the whole Donald Trump thing. I mean, I thought he sounded like a Democratic plant last night. He was using the Democrats' talking points against Walker, against Bush, against Rubio, you know, against Fiorina. I mean, he was Hillary Clinton's best friend up there.
Thanks, Kevin, for the call. We'll go next to Randy in Arborvita. Randy, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I can't help but thinking that it was I was really appalled by it.
Randy, I'm sorry, your line is breaking up. The gist, the producer tells me that he thinks he's surprised. He thinks it's ridiculous that Trump is still doing so well. Probably a lot of people, David, within the Republican Party, the establishment side, are thinking the same thing right about now.
Yeah, no, I mean, again, it's just unbelievable. I mean, we've seen this before a little bit, right? I mean, we saw this back in 2011 for the 2012 race where, you know, Michelle Bachmann had a moment and Herman Cain had a moment, but each of them quickly faded and they were replaced by the next person, whoever that was, Rick Santorum. The Trump thing is just growing. I mean, his support has actually literally grown in every single poll that has been done. It has been on an upward ascent where now you even have a majority of the party who thinks he is the likely nominee, a plausible nominee, and the best nominee to take on Hillary Clinton.
Talking to David Friedlander with the Daily Beast about last night's Republican debate, you can join in with your reactions and or questions. 800-642-1234 is the number to call. Want to get into Jeb Bush, somebody that a lot of people in the establishment liked, had high hopes for coming in. Let's check out a moment that he had with an argument with, it's getting redundant, an argument with Donald Trump. We'll give a listen.
Your brother and your brother's administration gave us Barack Obama because it was such a disaster those last 3 months that Abraham Lincoln couldn't have been elected.
You know what? As it relates to my brother, there's one thing I know for sure. He kept us safe. I don't know if you remember, Donald. You remember the rubble? You remember the firefighter with his arms around it? He sent a clear signal that the United States would be strong and fight Islamic terrorism, and he did keep us safe.
I don't know. You feel safe right now? I don't feel so safe.
So, David, Jeb Bush, one problem he'd been criticized for is not seeming to have an answer when people talk to him about his brother's presidency and about the Iraq War. Is he getting there now with this one thing I know for sure, as he said, line?
That was a great answer, and it was by far his most forceful of the night and his best moment of the night. I mean, I thought Jeb was really one of the few candidates up there who probably actually lost ground last night. He just seems so angry at Trump and having to debate Trump. I mean, he almost seems trembling with anger that he's even facing Donald Trump, and he almost doesn't quite know how to take him on because Trump is this phenomenon that we haven't quite seen. He doesn't answer questions properly. He spouts Democratic talking points. He talks in non sequiturs and broad strokes. And Bush seemed to freeze up and not really quite know how to take him on, I thought, for most of the night.
I want to mention the happy hour debate briefly. Last time, the first debate, Carly Fiorina was in that earlier undercard sort of debate. She stood out. She made it into the polls, did a little better, made it into this debate. Anything like that happened this time with, what is it, just four candidates in that early debate, right?
Yeah, I don't think so. I mean, that sort of kids' table, I guess as it's called, is getting smaller and smaller, right, now that Rick Perry dropped out and you know, Jim Gilmore didn't even make the threshold for it. So, you know, Lindsey Graham, I think, had a pretty good night, and Bobby Jindal got some zingers in. You know, but if the main attraction debate probably didn't you know, people were fading from the end and didn't change minds, I can't see how the undercard debate is really going to change matters much.
a lot of a primary race, especially maybe with so many candidates, is money, making sure you have enough money to keep your campaign afloat. You mentioned Rick Perry, some warning signs when he wasn't able to pay some key staffers. Do you see any candidates now really starting to get nervous? Are they going to be able to keep the donations coming in to sustain their campaign till the votes start being cast?
I mean, we live in such a different environment than we did 4 years ago or 8 years ago or however many years ago, where the money is so great and the super PACs are so prevalent that it, in a way it's really hard to run out of money. And, you know, these campaigns have also gotten cheaper in a way. So if you want to run a sort of lean operation, you can do so pretty easily. I mean, someone like George Pataki is probably not raising a lot of money, but he's raising enough to keep it going. Rick Santorum, enough to keep it going. I actually think your man Scott Walker is going to be the one to watch there. It seems as if donors are getting nervous about him and could start looking for other winners.
Right, because the understanding has been he was doing so well early on, he was not running a lean campaign. He was starting a major full-scale operation based on the donation levels he was getting back then.
Yeah, right, exactly. And, you know, if you start seeing people leaving his campaign or staff shake up, I mean, those are usually the sort of drip, drip, drip of the warning signs.
A three-hour tour, this debate. So was the public even watching it by the time it was over?
Gosh, you know, I don't know. I mean, it got bonkers ratings. I mean, there's something like 22 million people tuned in. It definitely would take some staying power to watch it towards the end. I mean, Trump really, you know, even he faded at the end there. And so, you know, how many people were really staying keyed up on it, I think it's hard to know at this point.
Now, we talked to you about the Fox debate earlier. One thing it was not was boring, as we talked about. They had very targeted, direct questions, hitting candidates on their negatives. What did you think of the style and the format of this debate?
Yeah, I really liked it. I mean, I thought it was good to kind of, for the moderator, Jake Tapper, to kind of get them talking about each other and drawing contrasts among themselves while on the debate stage. I mean, I would like to have seen a little bit more of Hugh Hewitt and Dana Bash, frankly. But, you know, I thought it was good because it's one thing to criticize your opponent from afar. It's another thing to criticize them when they're at your elbow. And, you know, and this was a crowd, unlike in the last debate, that was really against Trump. And the room did not work in Trump's favor. You know, in the last debate, there was a huge arena, the big audience, and he was able to, like, get them on his side. And this time, as we heard in some of the clips, the biggest applause lines were when people took it to Donald Trump.
So what are you looking for? What tea leaves are you reading next? What polls are you watching for to see how this second debate changes things, if at all?
I think the big thing is, when does the Trump phenomenon start to end? And, you know, if it doesn't end after this debate, when he seemed flummoxed by Carly Fiorina, when he was really unsure of some answers, when he seemed particularly sophomoric in other answers, if it doesn't end now, when does it end? I mean, if his next poll numbers are even greater than the ones he has currently, then, you know, are we ready to crown him the nominee? I think that'll be interesting. I think it'll be interesting to see how much Fiorina helped her cause. Is she going to really vault into the top tier of candidates? Does Carson, who had a middling debate performance last time and a middling debate performance this time, does that even matter? And then, you know, everyone else there, you sort of saw a little bit of desperation on their faces. They came in with a game plan. They knew they had to execute it. They knew it was one of their last chances. So it'll be interesting to see if anyone else gets a bump.
David, thanks a lot for joining us again.
Thank you.
That was David Friedlander, contributing writer at the Daily Beast, talking to us about last night's Republican primary debate. You can keep sharing your thoughts at the Central Time Facebook page.